From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Better late than never. The baseball season opens Tuesday, and we've got some great players in our lineup on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. Mickey Mantle tells us about being an American hero, and Jim Boughton tells us what certain American heroes are like when they're very drunk or very hungover. Also, pitcher Bob Gibson on intimidating the batter with a brush-off pitch, Keith Hernandez on sizing up the pitch, and Frank Robinson on sliding into second base spikes up. We take you out to the ballgame on this archive edition of Fresh Air, and to set you up for the weekend, we have a review of the new film Kiss of Death. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Attorney General Janet Reno has announced an arrest in connection with the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. She says 27-year-old Timothy McVeigh was arrested Wednesday in Perry, Oklahoma, on a traffic violation. Reno says McVeigh is one of the two men who were identified in composite sketches as John Doe No. 1 and 2. The other man has not been apprehended.
I remind everyone that John Doe number 2 remains at large. He should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. There is a strong likelihood that other persons are involved in this tragedy as well. People should not attempt to take any action against John Doe number 2 or anyone else involved in this matter.
The FBI says it carried out a raid at a three-story farmhouse in Michigan today in connection with the bombing. Two brothers are being sought in connection with the attack. They are named Terry Lynn Nichols and James Douglas Nichols. Meanwhile, rescue workers are still slowly trying to find victims from Wednesday's bombing. The death toll now stands at 57. Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating says workers are trying to go through the rubble to find people and preserve evidence at the same time.
I am very sensitive to the need to provide speedy notification to the families of the victims. I'm also sensitive to the fact that under state law, and obviously because we have a criminal act, there will be medical procedures performed before those victims can be returned to their families. Obviously, the identification process is a laborious one.
President Clinton has declared Sunday a national day of mourning for Oklahoma City victims. He's to make a statement very shortly. Consolidated Edison was fined $2 million today for hiding the fact that asbestos was released into the air during 1989, NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Judge John Martin imposed the maximum fine on the utility company, put them on a 3-year probation, and granted a prosecution request to appoint a federal monitor who will oversee Con Ed's future compliance with environmental laws. Last year, Con Ed pled guilty on charges of conspiracy and failure to report the release of more than 200 pounds of asbestos in the explosion of a steam pipe, which killed 3 people and wounded 24 others. Federal law requires notification if a pound or more of asbestos is released. At the time of the explosion, Con Ed denied that any asbestos contamination had taken place, concealing information both from federal authorities and the public. Residents in the area were allowed to move back into their apartments. No special safety precautions were taken in the cleanup effort. Asbestos has been linked to cancer and lung disease. It's unclear whether anyone suffered health problems as a result of the asbestos release. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
This is NPR. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 32.5 points to 4,263. Trading is heavy. The first round of France's presidential campaign ends tonight. Candidates are making a last-ditch attempt to rally support. They can't do any more campaigning until after the vote on Sunday. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The top candidate in the polls, Paris's conservative mayor Jacques Chirac, took a day off. But the other two leading contenders, socialist candidate Lionel Jospin and conservative Prime Minister Edouard Balladur, have been lambasting each other and Chirac all day. Balladur's tone has become increasingly shrill as he's plunged in the polls. He's now running third behind Jospin, which means he might not make it onto the second ballot in 2 weeks. However, polls show that a third of the electorate is still undecided. The stakes are huge. French presidents have enormous control over domestic and foreign policy, and the term is 7 years. Socialist President François Mitterrand, who's suffering from prostate cancer, has been in power 14 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
A federal appeals court has rejected California Governor Pete Wilson's attempt to block enforcement of the federal motor voter law, as it's called. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has denied Wilson's request for a stay of enforcement. The law, which took effect this year, requires states to let people register to vote when they apply for driver's licenses or welfare. Again, our top story this hour, federal authorities have arrested one of the two suspects sought in the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City on Wednesday. Reports say that Timothy McVeigh was arrested in Perry, a town some 60 miles north of the Oklahoma capital, on a driving violation. The FBI also says it has conducted a raid in rural section of Michigan in connection with the attack. The FBI is also seeking a pair of brothers named Nichols in connection with the bombing. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The baseball season opens Tuesday, finally. On today's archive edition, we feature interviews with great players. Mickey Mantle is one of the greatest hitters of all time. He was voted into the Hall of Fame in 1974. He played with the Yankees for his entire major league career, which lasted from 1951 to 68. Mantle came to New York from a small town in Oklahoma. I spoke to him in 1985 after the publication of his memoir, The Mick. He told me it was hard to adjust to the big city and to make the transition from Class C ball to the majors.
First of all, I wasn't Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio all rolled into one like they said I was going to be, and the people started booing me, you know. In fact, I got sent back to the minor leagues my first year. I started striking out a lot. I'd lost all my confidence. Casey had to take me out of a game in Boston because I struck out five straight times in a doubleheader. He took me out of the last game, and when we got to Detroit on the next trip, he sent me back down to the minor leagues, and I went like one for 25. That's one hit and 25 times at bat in Kansas City, which is AAA. And I'd really lost my confidence by then, so then I called my dad down in the mines, and I said, Dad, I don't think I can play anymore baseball. I'm down at Kansas City. I can't even hit here. He said, where are you at? And I said, the Aladdin Hotel. And he said, well, I'll be right there. And he drove all the way from Oklahoma up to Kansas City. And I thought he was coming up to be sympathetic with me, to pat me on the back and say, hang in there, kid, or something like that. When he came in the room, he just threw my suitcase on a bed and started throwing clothes in it. And I said, what's the matter? And he says, well, I thought I raised a man. He said, you're nothing but a coward. He said, you don't even have any guts. He said, I'm going to pack your things. You can come back to Oklahoma with me and work in the mines the rest of your life like I did. And I said, well, it took me about 30 minutes to talk him into giving me another chance, you know. And then afterwards, I started hitting again, and the rest of it's history.
Why do you think you fell into that hitting slump when you first joined the Yankees? Was it the difficulty of facing major league pitchers, which you weren't used to?
Probably. I never had hit major league pitchers before. They find out something. If one of them happens to throw a fastball high and inside where you can't hit it, and they find out you can't hit it, they have a little, they're like, they stick together, you know. Their word gets around fast. This pitch mantle, high fastballs on the inside of the part of the plate when he's hitting left-handed, and he can't touch it. So that it gets around. You got to learn to lay off of it.
When it became clear that you were going to be a great home run hitter, would you always go for the home run when you were up at bat?
Well, I went for the home run every time I swung at a ball. I was trying to hit it as far as I could. That wasn't just when I became a home runner. I was always a home run hitter from the time I was a kid. So that's all I like. I love to see how far I could hit a ball.
You started getting a lot of strikeouts when your home run record started to really rise. Were you swinging at anything in an attempt to actually get something that?
Anybody that hits a lot of home runs is going to strike out a lot, except Roger didn't strike out that much, neither did Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams. But most guys like Schmidt, myself, Babe Ruth, I broke Babe Ruth's strikeout record. I struck out 1,710 times, and when I retired, I was the most. But all the guys that strike out a lot are home run hitters. I mean, if you're going to hit the ball a long way, you have to swing hard. And if you swing hard, you're going to strike out a lot.
When you thought you had a home run, would you stand there and
no.
watch it, or would you just start running just in case?
The Reggie trot, I didn't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you
no.
didn't do that.
In fact, I never tipped my hat or did the high five or anything like that. It always embarrassed me, really, to see the opposing pitcher, because I knew how he must feel, because I knew how I felt when he struck me out. You know, he didn't jump up and down and wave his hands and tip his hat when he struck me out. So why should I do all that when I hit a home run off of him?
What did you think of your hero status in America? I mean, you were a symbol for, you know, just about every person, especially boys growing up in New York, and then across the whole nation. You were a symbol too. You were an American hero. You stood for baseball. You stood for, you know, what was good about the country. Was that a lot to live up to? Did it feel like you?
Well, yeah, you have to, you have to really watch yourself. I felt like I did anyway, and the Yankees always, you know, like I used to like to chew tobacco, and they made me quit chewing, or they asked me, they couldn't make you not do it, but they asked me don't chew tobacco because, you know, it don't look like a Yankee, and the kids now, they look up to you. If I was drinking, I would try to stay out of sight. You know, I never did smoke because I was afraid. I did do a Camel commercial one time, and I always wished I hadn't have because my dad didn't like for me to do commercials like that. I don't think he would have liked for me to do a beer commercial. I did one of those. I did a lot of things that I felt bad about later on, but at the time, it didn't seem that important.
Yeah, that same time that you were the national hero, you were really doing a lot of drinking, too, and I think you were famous for your carousing among baseball players.
I'm more famous for it now than I was then. A lot of people are surprised when they read that book because they didn't know I even drank. And if when you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic, but that's the farthest thing from the truth. It's just that the fun that I did have through my baseball career was when I was drinking. I mean, I guess my personality came in a bottle, for as I know, because the stories that I tell in that book are probably 15 or 20 things that happened over 18 years. If there is a moral to that book, it would be for little league kids or kids in high school or college, anybody, in fact, to take better care of their bodies, because guys like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial, all the guys that are really good and that are their names are at the top of the list in the lifetime statistics are guys that took good care of themselves and played 20 years. I was over the hill at 34 and had to retire at 36, and it's probably because I didn't take as good a care of myself as I should have.
In Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four.
I don't talk about Boughton's book.
You don't talk
no.
about it? Well, let me just say this, that he reported a lot of things about your drinking and also appetite for women and desire to like see women through looking through telescopes and stuff in hotel windows. Is that the kind of stuff that you think shouldn't be mentioned in print?
I've got some things in my book that probably shouldn't be mentioned, but they're in there, you know, and it's about me, though. It's not about somebody else.
Mickey Mantle, recorded in 1985. Coming up, an interview with Mantle's former teammate, Jim Boughton. This is Fresh Air. Jim Boughton's 1970 memoir, Ball Four, was considered scandalous at the time it was published. Boughton described players' behind-the-scenes antics, getting drunk, peeping through keyholes at women, and taking uppers before games. The kinds of things you didn't read about in sports magazines. Outraged baseball commissioner Bowie Kuhn said the book did a grave disservice to the sport. The book's champions thought it was about time sports writers stopped sanitizing the game for the public. These days, Boughton runs his own product development company. I spoke to Boughton in 1986, and he told me a story that might help explain why Mickey Mantle doesn't like to talk about Boughton's book.
I think the most controversial story in the book was I told about the time Mickey Mantle hit a home run with a hangover. And it wasn't really even so much as a put-down of Mickey Mantle as it was a story of what a great athlete he was. I told about the time we were in Minnesota, and we'd been out the night before a game having a few drinks, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess it was. I don't want to say Mickey was drunk, but he spent about a half an hour trying to make a telephone call from a grandfather's clock. So he comes into the ballpark the following morning, and he's hungover, and the manager says, you know, sleep it off. Most managers were players themselves. They understand you come to the ballpark once in a while with a hangover. So Mick is sleeping in the trainer's room. We're playing the Minnesota Twins. We got to stick somebody else in the outfield. And so the game's going on, and gets tie score after nine innings. And in about the 12th inning, the manager says, I hate to do it, but I'm going to need a pinch hitter in the 13th. Go in and wake up the Mick. So we go in the trainer's room, you know, wake up Mickey Mantle, dress him in his uniform, steer him through the tunnel up into the dugout. 13th inning comes around. He put a bat in Mickey's hands and point him in the direction of home plate. The Mick staggers up to the plate. Fortunately, he's a switch hitter. Doesn't matter what side he gets on. Steps into the batter's box. They show you what a great athlete this guy was, and Mickey was the best ball player I ever saw. He takes one practice swing, and it's the first pitch into the center field bleachers. A tremendous blast, 450 feet away. We win the game. The crowd is going nuts, and the players are going crazy in the dugout. We're laughing and pointing and screaming and slapping each other on the back, and suddenly it occurs to us, he still has to round those bases. There's a rule in baseball that you must touch the bases in order. Fortunately, heads off in the right direction. The minute he hits first base, the entire dugout goes, make a left. Goes around, touches second, touches third, comes across, misses home plate. We have to send him back for that. Comes over to the dugout, and of course, the fans are giving him a standing ovation. And as he's waving to the crowd, he looks at us in the dugout, and he says, those people don't know how tough that really was. I went over to his locker afterwards, and I said, how did you do that? You couldn't even see up there. He said, it was very simple. I hit the middle ball. So if this destroys America's illusions about baseball or Mickey Mantle, then I don't know what you do with all the literature that's come out since then, where each player tries to top the next in terms of what he can tell or how far he can go.
Well, did you have illusions when you were growing up of baseball players being perfect human beings?
Sure, I thought they were.
And very pure.
I thought they were all American kids. I really did. I thought you didn't drink, you didn't smoke, and you didn't stay out late at night, and that's how you got to the big leagues. And that's pretty much how I lived my life when I was a kid, and I finally got to the big leagues. My first night with the New York Yankees, we were on a road trip in Washington, D.C. I'll never forget this. We're staying at the Shoreham Hotel, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a knock on my door, and it's Whitey Ford, Mickey Mantle, Cleet Boyer, Ralph Terry, half the team are there. They want to take me up on the roof of the Shoreham Hotel to get drunk and look in windows. And I realized I wasn't in shape to be a major league ball player.
This is look in windows to see women undress.
Whatever. But it was crazy. I mean, I thought, geez, is this what it's like to be in the big leagues? But I still enjoyed playing baseball in the big leagues. I mean, I still thought Mickey Mantle was a great ball player. I stopped seeing ball players and athletes as super people. But I think that's a healthy thing, and I don't think anybody should look up to athletes as special people. They're not special people. They're ordinary people with special skills, and that's it.
Former pitcher and writer Jim Boughton is my guest. Pitching careers are subject to more problems than other careers are, I think, because your arm is so vulnerable and your career depends on your arm, and it's what you're abusing all the time.
Sure, and pitching is not a natural motion, throwing a ball as hard as you can, 120 times every 4 days is not natural. And it's going to take its toll on your arm. And a lot of people get sore arms and get burned out in high school, and they never ever get anywhere. Some guys do it and burn out in college. Some guys burn out in the minor leagues. Some guys burn out after 2 or 3 years in the big leagues, like I did. Others just can throw forever, seemingly. But it's hard to tell. You'd almost have to do a... You know, it's that they cut their arms open and figure out why some arms are able to tolerate it more than others.
You say that most pitchers are paranoid about their arm. What would you worry about or try not to do?
Well, you try not to sleep on it funny. You try not to, you never reach into your toilet articles bag for your razor with your right hand. When you're on the road trip, you always reach in with your left hand so you don't grab a razor blade. If you trip and fall, you immediately turn your body to the left. I have never gotten an injection in my right arm. I was always afraid of getting an infection, an infected needle, creating some sort of a problem. So you're always looking to protect your arm.
Did you have to change your pitching style because of injuries you were getting?
Well, I had to change my pitching style when I wasn't able to throw hard anymore. See, what happened was I threw very hard when I first came up. I was a overhand fastball pitcher. And then when I hurt my arm, I wasn't able to throw hard for a while. And then when I did, the ball didn't have that zip on it anymore. It didn't have that snap, even though the ball was traveling as fast, it wasn't moving. So it's like taking a rubber band and stretching it too far, and then it never gets its elasticity back again. And that's what happened to my arm. So I had to change from being a fastball pitcher to a knuckleball pitcher. Fortunately, when I was a kid, I threw a knuckleball, which is not a pitch that requires very much strength. It's a skill pitch. You push it off with your fingertips. The idea is to get the ball to go through the air without any rotation, and then it jumps around all by itself. And so I became a knuckleball pitcher to compensate for the fact that I couldn't throw hard anymore.
How hard are knuckleballs to hit?
They're almost impossible to hit when you throw a good one. The difficulty is throwing a good one. When you don't throw a good one, anybody can hit them. That's the problem with a knuckleball. Nobody can hit a well-thrown knuckleball, and almost anybody can hit a poorly thrown knuckleball.
Say it was a full count and there were a couple of men on base. What would you throw? Would you throw a knuckleball knowing that if you made one wrong move, it might be a home run because it's easy to hit?
I would throw a knuckleball. I would throw a knuckleball because my feeling is I would rather live and die with my best pitch than take a chance with something that wasn't my best.
Did you have any gestures that you had to do before you threw a pitch, you know, like rub your hand on your side three times or?
Nothing that was superstitious. I'm sure I went through the same sort of little rituals before I threw the ball because it's important to do that, and athletes need to do that, and many performers need to do that because those are the little steps that are really part of the process. Throwing a ball is not just throwing a ball. Part of it starts when you walk out to the mound, how you walk out to the mound, how you feel about yourself and the fans and the batter and the whole, all of that, the rosin bag in your hand, how that ball feels. And you want to start playing with that ball in your hand so you get that feeling. And you want to recreate the memory, the muscle memory that brings you back to the last time you were really throwing well. And that whole process starts long before you actually throw the ball.
Why do pitchers like to chew when they're on the mound?
Part of it is because of the nervousness and the tension, and it sort of chewing relieves that. But the spitting part is different, okay? Spitting and also all this crotch grabbing and spitting back and forth that you see in Major League Baseball, there's a real reason for that. There's a behavioral reason for that, and that is that what these are is macho displays, okay? It's a man-to-man challenge out there, the pitcher versus the batter, and it's very much like two cats squaring off where they both have to sort of urinate on the shrubbery saying, okay, this is my yard, I own this space, and the other cat saying, yeah, but I own my space, and then they're fighting. You see, what the batter is he steps into the batter's box and he spits all over the place. He's saying that's his turf. The pitcher's saying, oh, yeah, well, this is my turf out here, and now we'll see who's the best. And so that's why you have it's that mano a mano challenge situation, you know, and that's what they are. They're animals marking their territory.
Jim Boughton, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Jim Boughton, recorded in 1986. We'll have more baseball interviews in the second part of our show. Coming up, for those of you thinking of going to the movies this weekend, we have a film review. The producer-director Barbe Schroeder became a hot property in Hollywood with his last two films, Reversal of Fortune, for which he received an Oscar nomination in 1990, and Single White Female in 1992. But before that, he'd had a strikingly unusual filmmaking career, first as the Paris-based producer of films by Eric Rohmer, Jean-Luc Godard, and Wim Wenders, then as a documentary maker of movies about Idi Amin and Coco the Talking Gorilla, and a director of cult movies like Barfly.
Now he's directed a loose remake of the 1947 film noir that made Richard Widmark a star. Stephen Schiff has this review of Kiss of Death.
Say the words film noir, and people rightly think of post-war crime thrillers, mostly in black and white, with somber, innocent men, beautiful, vicious women, and predatory crime bosses all snared in the same fateful web. Oh yes, and lots of Venetian blind shadows on their faces. But a true film noir has to have one more crucial factor. Sometime during the drama, the good guy has to realize that he himself is capable of evil. The 1947 Kiss of Death was about the spider dance between a psycho and an informer. And when informers look inside, they can't help spying evil there. Ratting on somebody can never be entirely innocent. Barbie Schroeder's new version of Kiss of Death is about an informer, too, but this movie quickly leaves its source material behind to present a very complicated, very stylish, contemporary film noir. It manages to be both a headlong suspense thriller and a brainy character study at the same time. The hero's Jimmy, played by David Caruso, and he's being forced to wear a wire because the police have him over a barrel. They caught him in the middle of a crime. In the melee that followed, a cop named Calvin, played by Samuel L. Jackson, was shot in the face, and though Jimmy didn't do the shooting, Calvin blames him anyway. In this scene, Jimmy's just back from meeting the man he's informing on, and Calvin is debriefing him.
So I'll get that wire.
I threw it away.
What?
I threw it away. I got patted down twice tonight.
So you're all right with him. That'll make it easier.
Easier for what?
Easier to wear a wire.
Let me ask you a question. Why you? You know, why did they put you on me? Revenge?
You see this eye here? Runs all the time. I can't make it stop. I got a third of my hearing in this ear. And when I want to go to the beach, direct sun gives me a migraine so bad I cry like a baby. So I asked for you. And if you take that wire off one more time, I'm personally going to beat you to death.
Crime movies of the 30s and 40s used to be full of guys with physical peculiarities. It was a primitive comic book way of creating vivid symbolic characters. Kiss of Death uses the same technique, but Schroeder and his crack screenwriter Richard Price create such a detailed sense of authenticity on the screen that Jackson's perpetually teary eye feels completely believable, even though it's a shamelessly blatant symbol of the tragedy he and Jimmy get caught in. The movie's villain, Little Junior, is played by Nicolas Cage as a welter of eerie and contradictory traits. He's muscle-bound but asthmatic, psychotic but weirdly thoughtful, and Cage plays him unforgettably. In any other context, the performance would be wildly over the top, but again, this movie's grounding in reality keeps it down to earth, and so does David Caruso. When he walked out of the lead role in NYPD Blue last year, he was portrayed as a prima donna riding for a fall. But Caruso is a real movie actor, and maybe even a star. Underneath that shock of orange hair, his skin is so pale you feel you can see right through it to the angry blood quickening underneath. And his low voice makes you think he's holding in an explosion, talking very quietly, because if he doesn't, he knows he'll scream. I like the way Caruso lowers and tilts his head when he's mad, like an improbably sensitive bull turning things over in his mind before he charges. He's all potential energy, and even with Cage bouncing off the walls, you can't take your eyes off him. Kiss of Death has a strangely weak ending, but until then it's a muscular, graceful piece of storytelling, a model crime movie, and, even rarer, a contemporary film noir that measures up to the ones they made in the good old days.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on our archive baseball show, The Strategies of the Game. Frank Robinson was hit many times at bat because he liked to crowd the plate. We'll talk with him about how his outlook changed when he began managing pitchers for the Baltimore Orioles. The great pitcher Bob Gibson tells us about keeping the batter off balance. And how does a batter size up the pitch? Keith Hernandez tells us how. That's all coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Fire officials in Oklahoma City report the death toll from the bombing of the federal building has climbed by 1 to 58. Rescuers are still looking through the rubble of the building for more survivors. One suspect has been arrested in connection with the attack. Attorney General Janet Reno says 27-year-old Timothy McVeigh was arrested Wednesday for a traffic violation.
This announcement shows the substantial progress made by very dedicated law enforcement agents and officers in a very short period of time. But we continue to pursue absolutely every lead. We are determined that we will not rest until the people who perpetrated this terrible act are brought to justice and convicted.
The FBI says it has conducted a raid on a rural Michigan farmhouse thought to belong to a paramilitary group. It's not clear if authorities have detained any suspects there. But authorities are looking for two brothers, Terry Lynn Nichols and James Douglas Nichols, in connection with the bombing attack. President Clinton held a brief news conference this past hour. He says it's too soon to talk about the perpetrators' motives. He refused to discuss reports that the focus was now on domestic paramilitary groups rather than foreign terrorists. Mr. Clinton says the investigation is not close to being over.
Even though this is a positive development, this investigation has a lot of work still to be done in it. And therefore, it would be wrong to draw any conclusions. There have been lots of twists and turns in this investigation. But I would say to the American people, we should not assume, as I said yesterday, that we should not assume that any people from beyond our borders are involved in it. We should not assume anything except what we know.
President Clinton has declared Sunday a national day of mourning for the Oklahoma attack. He and First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton will attend a memorial service in Oklahoma. Democratic Congressman Bill Towson of Louisiana says the U.S. has the technology to prevent fertilizer from being used to make bombs like the car bomb thought to be used in Oklahoma City. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
Congressman Towson says, ironically, 25 years ago, when he was practicing law in Louisiana, he was approached by a man with a patented process to render the same kind of fertilizer used in the Oklahoma bombing harmless in the marketplace.
He was the only holder of a patent to do that. And when I brought it to the state legislature, they said, well, this is special interest legislation, and so we can't pass that. And they may have been right in that regard. But the irony is, if we had such a requirement that fertilizer be made harmless through this or some other process, perhaps we wouldn't have fertilizer in the marketplace that can be so easily converted into a bomb.
Towson says the technology to make fertilizer safer is readily available. The question is whether it's practical. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today. This is NPR News. Four people have died in a chemical explosion at a plant in Lodi, New Jersey. All the dead are workers. The blast erupted today after an explosion in a chemical factory. Several people are missing and others are hurt. The local mayor says the cause of the blast is not considered suspicious. The local fire department says it happened while chemicals were being mixed. By midday, officials say monitoring equipment no longer detected chemical fumes in the air. But there is chemical runoff in the site. State environmental officials say workers are trying to keep it from getting into the local Saddle River. A jury has found an upstate New York woman guilty of murdering five of her children more than 20 years ago. Tom Pachano of member station WSKG reports from Binghamton, New York.
The jury found Juanita Hoyt smothered her children between 1965 and 1971. Those deaths, originally attributed to sudden infant death syndrome, were questioned in a medical journal. After an investigation in Tioga County, New York, Hoyt confessed, a point the defense sought to discount. They said she was coerced by police. District Attorney Robert Simpson calls it a landmark case for other prosecutors.
Anybody, any jurisdiction in this country who has multiple deaths unexplained of this kind can take a look at it, and they've probably got a homicide in there somewhere.
Hoyt could face life in prison when sentenced in June. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Picciano in Binghamton, New York.
Again, our top story, federal authorities have arrested one of the two suspects sought in the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City on Wednesday. Reports say Timothy McVeigh was arrested in Perry, a town some 60 miles north of the Oklahoma capital. The FBI also says it has conducted a raid in a rural section of Michigan in connection with the car bomb attack. The FBI is also seeking a pair of brothers named Terry Lynn Nichols and James Douglas Nichols in connection with the Oklahoma bombing. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Britain says it has sent back to the U.S. a possible suspect in the Oklahoma City car bombing. The Justice Department describes the man as a possible witness and says he is not under arrest. British Prime Minister John Major had offered help after the explosion, as he told a meeting of Parliament today.
It is hard to convey the depth of feeling that I believe everyone will have in their hearts about the hideous act of barbarism and terrorism in Oklahoma and the misery and death that that's caused. I have been in touch with President Clinton. I have expressed our profound sympathy to him, to the country, to the bereaved and to the injured. And I have told the President that we're ready to help in any way we can.
Shortly after those remarks, Britain's Home Office said it had stopped a man at Heathrow Airport because of an alert by U.S. authorities. A Home Office spokeswoman says the man carried a U.S. passport and has been put on a plane back to the U.S. In Oklahoma City, rescue workers have returned to the federal building to resume the search for anyone who might still be alive. The teams had to cut off their search for a while today because of concern about the building's stability. The confirmed death toll remains at 36, but scores of victims are crushed under the collapsed floors of the building. NPR's John Burnett is in Oklahoma City, where he says many people's emotions about the attack are moving through grief to rage.
There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of fury here among people in Oklahoma. Now that 24 hours has passed, they're used to natural disasters. They're in the heart of Tornado Alley here, but they're not used to these man-made disasters, these deliberate disasters. And so a lot of folks are just really furious. They can't believe that other human beings would do this and cause the deaths of so many innocent people, especially children. There is a sort of a building anti-immigrant fervor here also.
NPR's John Burnett in Oklahoma City. Although the man deported from Britain was traveling on an American passport, officials in Italy say his luggage was headed for the Middle East. Police in Rome say they have intercepted the man's bags, which were en route to Amman, Jordan. President Clinton warned Americans today not to jump to conclusions about whether people from the Middle East were responsible for the bombing, and he said the attack is not a question of religion, but one of murder. The president also repeated his assurances that the perpetrators will be found and punished.
I would say to the children of this country, what happened was a bad thing, an evil thing. But we will find the people who did it, and we will bring them to justice. This is a law-abiding country, and neither the leaders nor the citizens of this country will permit it to be paralyzed by this kind of behavior.
President Clinton at the White House today. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 35 points at 4242.42 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is up 2 points. This is NPR. The president of the Philippines has ordered an autopsy by a neutral third party on the remains of a Philippine woman murdered in Singapore. Another Philippine woman was convicted of strangling the victim and was executed. Philippine authorities have protested that the victim was not strangled, but bludgeoned, and probably by a man. American experts already have joined with Philippine scientists to examine the findings of a Singaporean pathologist. Those Americans say the victim was strangled, and the woman who was convicted could have done it. France paid homage today to two of its peacekeepers killed in Bosnia last week, and it called for high-level talks among members of the international group working to solve the crisis in the former Yugoslavia. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Defense Minister François Léotard and the commander of the UN peacekeeping mission in Bosnia presided over a memorial service for the two French soldiers. Both of them were shot down by snipers in Bosnia. Lyotard told the crowd they fell because they were fighting against the return of ethnic and religious hatred in Europe. He said French troops would stay in Bosnia as long as they can accomplish their mission. France has demanded that the UN step up security for the peacekeepers. The foreign ministry said today that it's called for a high-level meeting of the contact group by the end of the month, before the ceasefire expires. Prime Minister Edward Balladur said that France would only keep its troops in Bosnia if the ceasefire is extended. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Bosnian government turned down the UN special envoy today as he tried to negotiate an extension of the country's truce beyond May 1st. UN official Yasushiya Kashi was rebuffed by government leaders who said the international community has not used the current four-month truce to force the rebel Serbs to accept a permanent peace plan. Kashi says he has not given up hope for an extension of the ceasefire, although the Serbs also have said they don't want to extend it. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're anticipating the start of the new baseball season with an archive show devoted to great players. Hall of Famer Frank Robinson has made several breakthroughs during his career. He was the first player to win both the American League and National League Most Valuable Player Award. In 1975, he became the first African American to manage a major league team when he was hired to guide the Cleveland Indians. In 1983, when he was with the San Francisco Giants, Robinson was named Manager of the Year. He's now Assistant General Manager of the Baltimore Orioles. I spoke with him in 1988.
In the majors, you developed a reputation for being a very aggressive player. One of the things you became known for was sliding into second with your spikes up and frequently knocking into the second baseman. What were your guidelines there? You say your ethic was win any way you can win within the rules. What were your kind of guidelines in your own head about how to slide into second and to be intimidating but not to take that too far?
Well, Terry, I'll tell you, I never slid into a base to intentionally hurt anyone, but I had a job to do, and my job was to try to break up the double play any way I possibly could do that. That's the way I was taught how to play the game when I was a kid, and that's the way I played the game throughout my playing career. And the idea was to go in there any way you possibly could. I never really, in my heart, went in with my spikes what I call high.
Mm-hmm.
But as people might know from the old days, as we said, old shoes, baseball shoes in those days had metal spikes on the bottom of them. And when I slid into the base, naturally those spikes were facing the infielder, the shortstop or the second baseman or whoever. And if it happened to come in contact with their body, the possibility of them being cut was there. And it did happen. And on occasions, it did happen. And just players thought that I was maybe a little vicious. But I was never vicious as far as my playing was concerned, as far as sliding into bases. You know, I was injured also with spikes. Sliding the second, I missed a shortstop. He went up in the air. He came down on my arm and gave me a 30 stitches in my bicep, and the doctor said if it had been half an inch lower, my career would have been over. But I didn't worry about it. I just had it stitched up and came back in 10 days and played.
You also used to crowd the plate a lot as a hitter. Explain the strategy of that, of standing really close to the plate when you're batting.
Well, I changed my stance when I came to the major leagues. I moved right up on top of the plate, and I bent over at the waist, and just stuck my elbows out over the inner part of the plate. And the strategy in that was to take the outside part of the plate away from the pitchers. I thought, and I felt like, and I still do, that the pitchers in the major league was much smarter and able to get the ball where they wanted to, much more so than they did in the minor leagues. And I didn't want to give them the outside part of the plate because that's the biggest part of the plate, and I thought they could more consistently make their pitches out there. So that's why I did that.
So it gives you certain advantages over the pitcher. On the other hand, it's a kind of dangerous position to take because you're more likely to get hit by a ball if you're that close to the plate.
No, it's no doubt about it. I was hit 198 times.
Is that a record?
It was for a while until Ron Hunt came along and he upped the record to 250 times.
Wow.
And now Don Baylor has it going is close to 300 times right now and counting. So it was quite a few in those days, and so now look at Don Baylor, been hit almost 300 times. It's mind-boggling, really. But You know, that was all part of the game. I would be thrown at, knocked down, and whatever, and you would get up and just do damage to the pitcher with the bat. And that's the only way I looked at it. I didn't really worry about it, as long as I didn't feel like a pitcher was throwing at my head intentionally.
What were your tricks for getting out of the way of the ball?
Recognizing the pitch right away, knowing that it's a fastball rather than a curveball. And certainly if a fastball is up and in, you better get down real quick. And we were taught to roll our front part of our body back towards the screen. In other words, you roll your front shoulder back and hopefully and pull your, tuck your head down and into your body to protect your head and face so the ball would hit you in the meaty part of your back so you wouldn't be hurt very seriously.
You have said that when a pitcher threw intentionally at a player on your team, that you would tell your pitcher to try to reciprocate in some way?
Well, at times, if I thought they were doing it intentionally because a hitter had been hot and had been hitting the ball pretty good against that pitcher or that ball club, I have at times early in my career as a manager said to our pitchers, I want you to hit this guy on the knee. I never said in the head or anything like that. I always made the target lower than that I thought maybe the pitcher might aim at. So I always said, hit this guy on the knee. But I can honestly say I can't remember any pitcher really going out there and doing that. I had some that tried to do it. They threw the ball back to the backstop to hit the screen. They threw the ball in the dirt and missed the player by 3 or 4 feet. But I can't really remember a pitcher really after I told him to do that going out there and doing it.
Let's get back to your ethic of win any way you can within the rules. Did you think of like telling a pitcher to to hit someone as being within the rules?
Well, I thought so. I think being hit is within the rules. That's all part of baseball and has been ever since baseball has been played. And what you do is you're saying, I'm protecting my own. The hitters are going up to home plate trying to score runs for the pitcher. And the only way our pitcher is going to win ball games is if we do score runs. And if the other team is taking advantage of the situation and throwing it out of hitters to try to make them a little gun-shy at the plate or hitting them to where they cannot stand up there and do their job with the bat, then he has to protect his teammates. And that's the only reason why, on occasions, that I asked my own pitchers to do that.
Frank Robinson recorded in 1988. Bob Gibson talks about pitching after a break. This is Fresh Air. Baseball Hall of Famer Bob Gibson is one of the greatest pitchers in history. He won the National League's Most Valuable Player Award in 1968, the year he won 22 games, led the league with 268 strikeouts, and had an earned run average of 1.12, a major league record. He shut out every team except the Dodgers. During his career with the St. Louis Cardinals, he had a reputation for not talking much with the press and for revealing as little about himself as possible. Last year, I talked with him about pitching.
You used to use the brushback pitch. Tell me about your strategy for when the brushback would be the appropriate way to pitch to someone.
Well, when I played, that's the way the game was played. And the brushback pitch really isn't what it sounds like. What you do, you throw the ball in off the plate. The idea of getting a hitter out, you don't get him out inside. You get him out away. And so what the hitter tries to do in order to keep that ball away from being away, they'll lean over the plate, and then the ball away is more or less either from the middle of the plate in. So you don't want him to lean over. You pitch inside off of the plate. Now you make him think about that ball coming in here. And if he's not thinking about it coming in there, probably it will hit him. So what the hitter likes to do is to either look for the ball inside or look for it away. To keep him from looking for it away, you throw him inside, get him off the plate, which people call a brushback pitch, and then you throw him away.
I guess you know your aim has to be awfully good if you're pitching inside when the batter's crowding the plate, otherwise you'll hit the batter.
Right. I didn't hit batters that often. And they knew that I would pitch inside. And this is one of the weapons that you have. If you throw inside often enough, they know that you're going to come in here. So they're aware of the ball being inside, and that's why you're so effective away. Very seldom will you hit a guy inside. If you want to hit him, you don't throw it inside anyway. You throw it behind him.
Why is it? Why?
Well, because the first instinct is to move back. And so if you throw a ball behind a guy and he moves back, usually it'll hit him.
No, were there times when you intentionally tried to hit a batter?
Oh, sure. And usually that was retaliation. We had a couple of guys, Lou Brock, Kurt Flood, and Julian Javier. They got hit constantly. They were very fast. They get on the bases and they just drove you guys nuts. So they did get hit. And whenever one of my guys got hit when I was pitching, I would just return the favor.
Now, you hit Duke Snider once and broke his elbow?
Oh, he hit himself.
He hit himself?
Yeah.
Why don't you explain that?
Well, Duke Snider was a pull hitter, dead pull hitter, and he liked the ball inside. He's a left-hand hitter, and they first moved out to the Coliseum. The Coliseum's right field fence was a long way away, but the left field fence was only 250 feet away, and Duke Snider did not hit the ball to left field. First time I faced him, he hit a home run over that little fence out there, which was fine. You know, okay, I'm going to have to start pitching him a little differently. I pitched him away a little farther, about 3 or 4 inches outside, and he reached out and hit the ball. It would have been a home run, but it went foul, and that was the second time up. Well, the next pitch I threw him was inside. Here we go with this pitch that I'm telling you. It keeps the guy from leaning out. Well, he went back out there thinking that the ball was going to be outside, and it hit him in the elbow, broke his elbow.
How did you feel when that happened?
Oh, it was his fault. It wasn't mine. And, in fact, I went over to talk to him after the game, and he told me. He says, yeah, he says, I was leaning out there, and I shouldn't have been doing it.
Hmm. Did you ever get hit while you were at bat?
Sure. I got hit a lot.
Was that retribution against your pitching?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was the way the game was played.
Boy, so every time you intentionally hit a batter, did you figure, well, that means I'm going to get hit when I'm at
bat? Well, we're making it sound like...
Like it happened a lot of times, which it
yeah,
didn't.
Yeah, and it
right.
didn't happen that right. often. See, you got a guy back there called the umpire, and he usually stops all of this.
Right.
When somebody gets hit on my team, and I go back out there and I hit somebody on that team, the umpire will call timeout. He says, okay, guys, that's enough. And usually that is enough, and it stops.
Right.
So you don't spend all game throwing at each other.
Mm-hmm, right. Just tell me more about what your strategy was like when you were on the mound.
All right. We would go into a town, for instance, going into Philadelphia, and we have a three-game series. The first game of each series, we have a report from the scouts, and we would go over each individual hitter. We knew exactly how to pitch them, how to play defense against them. And so what you would do, you would go over it and refresh your memory on what to do. So that's not to say that you would pitch like that all the time. But if you got into a situation where this guy could beat you with a base hit or a home run or what have you, then you went to your strategy. You went to those scouting reports. And pretty much if you stayed there, you'd get the guy out. But if you were continually pitching a guy according to that, most of those hitters are good enough to adjust to that. So you try not to pitch them like that all the time.
Bob Gibson recorded last year. Next up at bat, Keith Hernandez. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on the arrests in Oklahoma City?
We're keeping up with the story both in Oklahoma City, Terry, and in Decker City, Michigan, where officials are moving against a group called the Michigan Militia. We will be explaining who the Michigan Militia are and what they're about, and we'll be following the progress of the investigation on all fronts. Also, we're going back to the site of the explosion to talk to rescue workers about what they are trying to do now. We'll talk to a survivor who tells an extraordinary story about climbing down knotted curtains to get out of the building. And we will be talking to a psychologist about kids in this explosion.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our
archive edition today is about baseball in anticipation of the long-awaited start of the season. Our final guest is former star first baseman Keith Hernandez. He played with the St. Louis Cardinals, the New York Mets, and the Cleveland Indians during his 17-year career in Major League Ball. He was named Most Valuable Player in 1979 and won the Gold Glove Award for first base 11 years in a row. He was also known for having a near-perfect swing. I spoke with Keith Hernandez in 1994 after the publication of his book Pure Baseball, Pitch by Pitch for the Advanced Fan. How do you develop a good eye as a batter? When you were up at bat and you were trying to follow a pitch, what would you look for?
Basically, if you're getting down to the nitty-gritty, you, as a hitter, have to concentrate on the point of release where the pitcher lets go of the ball. Whenever some pitchers throw overhand, some three-quarters, some sidearm. So you basically focus on wherever they release the ball. And you do see the motion, but it's all kind of around the periphery of your main focal point, your concentration point, a point of release. And then once the ball is released out of his hand, then your eyes have, in a split second, obviously, have got to really zoom in on the baseball and identify the pitch, which is why we have little red seams in the ball, because each pitch has a telltale giveaway with the rotation. If we didn't have the red seams in the ball and the ball was all white, the hitters, there would be no 300 hitters.
Right.
You get that?
So, were you usually accurate in what you assessed a pitch to be?
Well, I think I was accurate pretty much all the time. Every pitch has a giveaway in the rotation. Fastball comes in, and the ball's all white. If a pitcher throws a curveball, he is spinning the ball kind of like in an orb. The red seam makes like a moon orbiting the Earth or whatever. The ball is spinning in like a 1 o'clock. Let me get my times right. 1 o'clock to 7 o'clock mode. So it's like a tiny moon orbiting in a red line, and that tells you instantly it's a curveball. And make this as simple as possible. Slider. The seams make a little tiny red circle right in the middle of the ball, and everything else is white. So you know right away your mind says slider. Knuckleball has no spin. The split finger fastball, which made it so difficult, was that it did not have any telltale giveaway. It comes in like a fastball and then drops. So that's what makes that pitch so difficult. So there's an art to it, no question.
In your book, Pure Baseball, you talk a little bit about sometimes peeking at a catcher's signals to see what they were telling the pitcher to do. How would you do that, and how often would you do it?
That seems to be the one everybody's most fascinated with so far. It's not really looking at the signals, because you couldn't. The key is I would do it only in certain situations late in the game if there's men on base. Mm-hmm. And some people might call this cheating. I don't. I'm looking for where the catcher is setting up. If I have a left-hand pitcher and I was a left-hand hitter, if the catcher is setting up outside, it's going to be either a fastball or a breaking ball away. If he's setting up inside, on the inside corner to me, he's not going to throw a curveball in there. It's for sure 100% going to be a fastball, and he's going to try to throw it inside. So what I would do when a pitcher would go in a stretch, because I'd only do it in situations late in the game where I could hurt him and maybe blow the game open or win the game or tie the game, etc., whatever. He'd go into a stretch. I would just, without moving my head, I would just kind of look out of the corner of my eye, and if I could see the catcher, he was set up outside. If I couldn't see him, he was set up inside. Now, you run the risk of a catcher setting up inside, and then as you peek back, he can shift back to the outside. That's the risk you take. But if you're observant, you watch your catcher, and you see what kind of pattern he has, what kind of habits he has back there. There were certain catchers I knew I couldn't peek on because they moved around and they would set up inside and move outside or vice versa.
How legit is it to peek at a catcher?
How legit?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I think a couple pitchers got a couple losses on their record because I peeked late in the count. But it wasn't something, you can't do it all the time because the classic example, if they think you are, they're going to set up outside and make it obvious. You're going to think it's outside and they're going to hit you right in the head.
Right.
So there, and you have no gripe. You got it coming. So it was something I didn't do every day. Should I go to jail for this? Is this a felony? I feel like, yeah, I'm on the witness stand. I only picked my spots on it. So it was very, very rare situations. And, of course, when I was red hot and really swinging the bat good, or had a pitcher that I had good success off of, or I had success that particular day, I wouldn't have to. But if a certain pitcher was in there that was tough and I wasn't swinging the bat that good, you know, for knowing location on the pitch, whether it's in or out, for one pitch of the at-bat, now I would try to take advantage of it.
If you were on a streak, either a good streak or a bad streak, what would you do? How would you try to keep a good streak good, and how would you try to break out of a bad one?
To maintain a good streak, that's one of the things that, I mean, what makes you go into a slump and what makes you break out of a slump? Why do you go into a slump one day after you've been swinging a bat good for 3 weeks and you come to the park that day and boom, you've lost it? And then a 2-week slump and coming to the park and not having any clue, like you've never had a bat in your hand your whole career, and all of a sudden you come to the park one day, boom, and you break out. It's something you can't put your finger on. Now, the Lord will only give you so many base hits if he really cares about baseball. I think he's a baseball fan up there, that's for some reason. When you're red hot, you only have so many good swings, and I would take less batting practice. I didn't want to waste those swings. I would just go, I felt good at the plate. I would take a couple rounds to get loose. Normally, in a day-to-day, when you go take batting practice, you have around 5 rounds, the starting lineup, around 40 swings. I would take 15 just to get loose, get out of the box. Now, when you're in a slump, there's all kinds of things you can do to break out. I mean, you can take extra batting practice, come to the park early, which is a positive thing to do. But then you can overdo that. Sometimes you get in a slump when you just... you have no clue, and you just say, okay, I'm just not even going to hit today.
Were you a superstitious hitter?
I think every athlete is superstitious. I was superstitious, but not when it came to slumps. When you're in a slump, you're groping and trying to find the quickest way to get out. I mean, I wore my socks a certain way. I knew what sock went on my... that was my superstition. I knew what sock went on my right foot and which one on my left foot, and every year the first hot streak I got into, whatever foot, the leg that sock was on, I'd keep it on the rest of the year. I had a ritual that I did in the on-deck circle, that I did everything the same way. It was very precise and neat, and had my the pine tar rag on one side, the towel to the other, and the rosin bag and all that stuff. I had I kept house there, so to speak. So, I don't know. It's just one of the things, one of the idiosyncrasies of me when I play.
Keith Hernandez, recorded last year. More interviews from our archives next week. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.